This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
This week on Dialogue on the Coast 89.7, a holiday special for you. We'll hear from some of Cape Breton's best-known storytellers to help put you in the Christmas spirit. Paul McDougall from The Good Sentence was at the library in downtown Sydney after hearing Ken Chisholm read a story with a bit of a chilling twist, so he asked Ken to do it again for our listeners on Dialogue. Then Paul will wrap up the show with a reading of his own. But up first, Ron Kaplan of Breton Books has been collecting Christmas stories for a number of years. That series is The Gift That Keeps on Giving. Ronald will explain what that means in just a moment, and then he will read from the latest volume of the collection, Cape Breton's Christmas Book 9.
Christmas stories are something, you know, they come to mind maybe just for the family themselves, and they perhaps are told for a year or two and then sort of forgotten. And for some reason, I had this idea of why not just put out a call, see what kind of response we got. We got a very good response. People really interested, remembering happy Christmases and Christmases that were not so happy. Remembering things that happened to their family, remembering their own parents' Christmas that they would make for the children 20, 30, 40 years ago. And people were writing in. And when I say writing in, most of these are unpublished people. They've never had a story published anywhere. And they really did a remarkably good job. As an editor, I had very little to do to make the stories acceptable for print. People really cared about this project. And what they cared about even more than the saving of stories, they cared about the fact that all the royalties, that was just an idea that I had, that all the for the first book, all the royalties were given, donated to Feed Nova Scotia. And when people heard that, not only were they interested in sharing stories, but they thought it was really an excellent project, and so we started sending the royalties. Now it's 9 years later, and we've sent the royalties for the first 8 books to Feed Nova Scotia, and the amount of it comes to well over $8,000 so far that's gone to Feed Nova Scotia. And as long as those books sell, and people still buy book 1, 2, 3, as well as the current one, royalties will be sent to Feed Nova Scotia. So I really like the project. I like it as a person who cares about local stories and folklore being saved. We've saved and published, 450 stories in the series so far. And stories continue to come in, and then on top of it, we're sending these donations of all the royalties from sales on to Feed Nova Scotia. We do it through a project of CBC Radio called Light Up a Life.
You said you'd be kind enough to read a story or two from the latest book. That's Cape Breton's Christmas book, number 9, of course. And so whenever you're ready there, Ronald, please go ahead.
So, well, I guess it's called The Week. 'Twas the Week Before Christmas. It was written by April MacDonald, a reporter of the Inverness Oran. During a whopper of a whiteout blizzard years ago, while most people were hunkering down, there were 11 travelers on a maritime bus heading to Halifax. When they had driven the distance to Waikagama, the only thing that was clear was that the driver knew that they weren't going any further. The bus was scheduled to arrive in Waikagama by 10 a.m., but because of the weather, they didn't get there until 4:30 p.m. The owner of Vi's Restaurant, Beatrice McLeod, who'd been at the restaurant since 5:30 that morning, gave all the passengers shelter from the storm. Beatrice, her daughter Beverly Ehler, and another Vi's restaurant person, Mary Crane, warmed the passengers' hearts and bellies by feeding them supper and supplying a place for them to rest their heads for the night. Beatrice's brother, Miles, gathered blankets from the local fire department and a few more from his home for the weary travelers. The owner, knowing they were safe, warm, and fed, then left the stranded travelers at the restaurant so she could go home and get some rest before opening the restaurant on Saturday. And when she returned Saturday morning, she made them all breakfast to get them started on their long journey again. Here's what the Nova Scotia International Students Programs Julian Sexton and Heather McNeil had to say about the blizzard and the ties that bind. They were writing about this event, and they wrote, "As we look back on the last few days, we only smile at the memories, friendships, and adventure we encountered on our trip to Halifax Airport to say goodbye to our four students from Spain. What started out as a few flurries and wind erupted into a full-fledged blizzard 15 minutes from the community of Waikaugama. The bus driver had decided it was not safe to continue, so we pulled into Vi's restaurant. And what started out as a short break lasted 23 hours with two homestay coordinators, four students from Spain, a Screaming Eagles hockey player, a retired paint salesman, two Cape Breton University students from India and Japan, a man named Andy, and the bus driver. Now, the totally amazing part was the owners not only fed us before leaving in a full blizzard, but allowed us to stay the night with full use of the kitchen and the fridge. Only in Cape Breton would an owner of a restaurant leave total strangers, giving them free rein. The owner's brother left and collected bedding from the fire station and neighbors close by to keep us warm. And throughout the evening and night, 14 strangers became friends. Although we were given the Wi-Fi password, because of the storm, it didn't work. So we talked. Imagine that. We played cards, charades, word games. Some slept curled up in booths while the young ones laughed and talked into the early morning hours, never once complaining about no internet. The young man from Cape Breton, Screaming Eagles, only 17, was like a celebrity to our students. He even gave our young man from Spain a hockey stick to take home. Well, it made his night. And he was wanting the coordinator to call at 2 a.m. to see if he could take it. At 5 a.m., the owner came back to begin her day, prepared hot breakfasts of bacon, ham, eggs, pancakes, toast, and all of it free of charge. At 10 a.m., 23 hours later, we were picked up to continue our journey to the airport. The students and passengers hugged the owner and staff, thanking them for their kindness, restoring all faith in human kindness. And as we continued close to Halifax, one by one, we said goodbye to our new friends, never to forget our night at Vi's restaurant. And we thought of this song. Think of your fellow man. Lend him a helping hand. Put a little love in your heart. And the world will be a better place.
Listening to that story, Ron, very easy to imagine sitting around the fireplace or by the Christmas tree, listening to someone read a Christmas story like that. And it's even better, I think, when it hits close to home. Many people, of course, know that spot in Waikaugama, probably passing by it 1,000 times, where Vi's restaurant was. And the young celebrity there from the Screaming Eagles, that was really good stuff. And Ronald, I bet there are a lot of people who would like to have this local connection or to enjoy hearing stories like this at this time of year. For many, it would sure beat shopping in the crowded stores, I think. This would certainly adds a lot to someone's Christmas experience.
These these stories and the books in the books called Cape Breton's Christmas, for many people, they've become another holiday tradition. I'm told about families that gather again around the Christmas tree and read from Cape Breton's Christmas, read these stories to one another at the same time as they're sitting under the tree, they're sharing presents, things like that. I heard about two sisters who are unfortunately unable to be together. They live in different towns in Ontario, and neither is able to travel. And so they get on the telephone, and they read stories back and forth, one each night, to one another, and they discuss them. And they're reading from Cape Breton's Christmas.
Ronald, we still have more time. Would you be kind enough to read another story, please?
This is Donna Damore. You may know her as Donna Doyle. So the story is called I Resolve, and it goes like this. As January 15 draws closer, and with it the first credit card statement of the new year, I have one resolution I am determined to keep. I will never again do all my Christmas shopping in November. This year, I was very smug. By November 15, all of my gifts were wrapped and packed in a box in my upstairs closet. By November 30, I discovered four of these gifts would no longer do. One friend raved about the great book she was reading. I thought she'd like it when I bought it for her 2 weeks ago. Number one gift was unwrapped and exchanged. A second friend announced by December her December wedding, and I was left with personalized stationery that couldn't be exchanged. Number three gift was done by a friend who quit smoking. Number four was the toy of the season in November. I searched three malls for it. Excuse me. My daughter saw it advertised on TV and pronounced it gross. By December 7, these gifts had all been replaced, and I was smug once more. I was still weeks ahead of my friends. Hubby gave me his gift early, a tidy sum of money. We've made it a tradition ever since I informed him his Christmas surprises were more like shocks to my Yuletide cravings. I leisurely shopped for new clothes and enjoyed the self-indulgence. I had earned it. You're so smart, everyone said when I answered the same question for the 100th time. All ready for Christmas? I was. Then something dreadful happened. By December 21, all of the stores announced sales. Flyers filled with my mailbox. One by one, each gift I'd purchased was reduced by 30, 40, even 50%. I was having a hard time feeling merry. The price of decking the halls was dropping drastically, and my halls were pre-decked. My friends wouldn't know if I'd bought their gifts before or after they were marked down. Oh, I know. It's the thought that counts. But honestly, when you unwrap your brand new sweater, doesn't the thought slash to $15.95 last week at Wolco ever run through your mind? Even the selection had improved. I saw perfect gifts in the newspapers and on TV. I regretted buying every gift, and if only I'd waited, I could have bought nice gifts at half the cost. In the depths of despair, I forced myself to turn away from my commercial failure and seek the true meaning of Christmas. I dug out the manger and set it up in the living room. I told my children the story of Christ's humble birth. I taught my four-year-old the names of the nativity characters, ending with the three wise men bearing gifts. my materialistic worries seemed petty. I settled down with my family to watch Dickens' A Christmas Carol. It was uplifting to see the true spirit of Christmas revealed. The priceless gift of love is more than enough for anyone. I knew that, but I guess I forgot. I did notice, however, that Scrooge wisely left his shopping till Christmas Day.
Thank you so much, Ronald. Always a pleasure to hear from you. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Thank you. I appreciate this, Bill. Thank you very much.
Hi, my name's Ken Chisholm, and the story is called Anything But Dead. There have been certain hours of certain nights when the dead have come to visit me, always rehearsing their old complaints. The dead are full of complaints and the need to sound them to their depths, and by these standards, the dead find me easy company. I have no fear of them. I live alone, so I seek constant distraction, and I'm a good listener, always looking for material for my writing. This particular night was in early September. Summer had passed, school had begun, the cool night air of autumn breathed through my bedroom window. I woke aware of three shadowy shapes in my bedroom. At that moment, the paired beams of a car's headlights swept up from the street through my bedroom window in an arc. The lights passed through what should have been solid forms, but instead illuminated empty air. The car passed and the forms reappeared, faintly glowing green in the night dark. I was not startled or afraid. I came out of a deep sleep and still had access to the logic of the dreaming brain. They were the dead, and I had to suffer their company. They were a mixed group, a young girl with long pale hair wearing a two-bit hand-sewn pinafore-like dress, a tall aristocratic man, perhaps in his mid-30s, in a finely tailored velvet suit with a ruffled cravat, knee breeches, and black gold-buckled leather pumps, and an elderly gentleman in patched work trousers, heavy Kodiak work boots, and a cardigan over a frayed collared work shirt. Like all of the dead I have encountered, they dimly shone with a greenish tone as they cast their vacant eyes around the dark interior of my bedroom. The dead, in my experience, disdain eye contact. The most unexpected aspect about this encounter was when they spoke, or more accurately, their mouths moved while I heard their voices in my head. "Return," the little girl with a slight Gaelic accent said. "Returne," the tall aristocratic gentleman pronounced in a nasal intonation. "Return," the old man in the sweater said, in a feisty Glace Bay accent, but which district I could not identify. "Return to where?" I made the mistake of blurting out. The spectral three turned to regard me. "Return to where?" I repeated. Their faces seemed to burn green with consternation, and then with a combined yell of frustration, they blinked out of my perception. "The rolling mill is a mess," a squat balding man in dirty coveralls spat at me from the brightly lit entrance to my apartment kitchen. "Is there a problem?" I said. His left eye was slightly askew, and the small finger on his left hand was missing. "It's not my problem," he spat at me. "Well, I can't fix it," I said calmly, stirring my simmering spaghetti sauce. "I knew you would say that," he said, walking into the wall behind him and out of my perception. Another night, a careworn woman in a house dress decorated with faded printed yellow daisies, who paced up and down the hallway from my bedroom to my living room for several nights before she spoke to me, saying in an accusatory tone, "You're never going to set that boy straight." "He won't listen to me," I replied. "You should talk to him." "You're the one who told me to keep out of it," she said, burying her face in her hands and turning her back on me. An old man wearing wire glasses stood looking longingly at my bookshelves in my spare room. I picked a book at random from the shelf and held it out to him, saying, "I can hold it open for you if you want." He looked confused, slightly smiled, and fell out of my vision in a swirl of shadow. Ever since my first encounter with the dead, it seemed so long ago, but it was probably just a year or more, these three encounters typified my encounter with the dead. They spoke no Jacob Marley orations on their lives, the secrets of the afterlife stayed secret. No plea to have an unrighted wrong remedy was bent. They knew nothing. They acted on nothing. They decided nothing. Not because they were afraid or complacent or angry or at peace. Their lives were simply done. They had no power to right their own wrongs, nudge the living to a better direction, or interact with the physical world. They were dead. Their continued presence, even their annoying intrusion into my life, had no consequence. The dead, I concluded, were useless and boring, and I was stuck with them. But why was I a favorite among the dead? Well, because I was part of a group, and we would get together once a year to read our original ghost stories as a fundraiser for our local library branch, an event now in its second decade of presentation. Because of this, audience members assumed I liked nothing better than to listen to their reportedly true encounters with the dead. "After my grandmother died," one lady told me, "I began finding dimes all over my house. And I remember when, how I was a kid, Nana always gave me a dime to buy candy at the corner store. And here she was, still treating me." I suffered through more family tales of the dead, many of them attributed to a now also dead relative, or second cousin's wife's mailman, or, without attribution, simply lifted from a book of folklore. Then there were the many storytelling sessions I moderated as the regional library's storyteller in residence, in town halls and other venues where attendees would invariably share tales of the supernatural. These I found more in line with my experience with the dead. Inconclusive, frustrating, lacking a tidy moral or a social lesson. After a few years, I was immersed in ghost stories, ghost lore, ghost trivia, ghost songs, ghost tales, ghost metaphors, ghost movies, and did occasional ghost tours for the old Sydney Society for cruise ship visitors. So, just because they occupied my mind so much, it was perhaps inevitable the dead would find me an easy mark for their useless, tiresome visits. The three returned to my bedroom near midnight on Halloween, of course. The Halloween traditions followed the old Celtic traditions of Samhain, when the veil between the two worlds is at its most permeable. Their visit on Halloween was brief and literally to the point. "So, you have returned to me," I said, a Halloween full moon filling my bedroom with its pale, unblinking light. That drew the full attention of the three of them. They spread out and formed a semicircle in front of where I sat on the edge of my bed. I was waiting for them to speak to provide another clue to the motivation prompting their visits. Instead, they said nothing, looked me fiercely in the eye, and each lifted a spectral arm, and each pointed a finger at me, and then blinked out of sight to the crack of a snapping rope. The next morning, I went to the government wharf to meet the last cruise ship of the season and gathered the group of visitors who bought tickets for my final spooky walking tour. The sky was dark with clouds, and though it was the middle of the day, it felt like dusk, the kind of day the dead favored to occasionally shadow me as I led my tour. The dead, besides coming to my apartment at night, visited me during the day in coffee shops, convenience stores, seemingly whenever I turned around, and also on my ghost tours. One overcast day, I noticed my tour group had swelled in size, infiltrated by the dead who, from the way they were dressed, came from various time periods, looking in different directions as if searching for something in this crowd of strangers. I told my joke that if someone rented an apartment in the historic north end of Sydney and it didn't have a ghost, they demanded a rent discount. The tour itself included three graveyards, so the dead, even in the outdoors, were always within hailing distance. But today, All Souls Day, they decided collectively to shun me. None of the dead, including some I considered regulars, appeared during the tour. I felt a growing unease about their failure to appear. In front of the graveyard, next to the old stone Anglican church, I felt compelled to tell my tour group about my visits from the three dead and their recent accusatory gesture. As might be expected, a lot of people who go on ghost tours have experience or knowledge of the supernatural, and I felt I could use some advice, so I did an in-person version of crowdsourcing with an actual crowd. "Then what happened?" a woman with a Boston accent asked at the conclusion of my tale. "They pointed at me and disappeared," I said. "And you woke up, right?" an older man wearing a Detroit Tigers baseball cap said with a knowing chuckle. "He was awake," a dimply-faced Englishwoman said emphatically in my defense. "But they were trying to indicate something by pointing, Peach Cup," said her husband in his most cheerful mansplaining voice. "You're next," the Detroit Tigers man called out in a very theatrical tone as he dramatically pointed his finger at me. Half the tour group laughed and also pointed their fingers at me, calling out, "You're next," or "Yes, you're next," and "You're so next." I began to guide them to the old Sydney Society Museum with the promise of tea and cookies. A woman in her 30s with spiky lilac dyed hair asked, "Do you mind if I use the app on my phone to scan you for psychic emanations?" Before I could say yes, she waved her device up and down in front of me. She gave me a slight frown and said, you're not registering anything. And that means, I said. It's like you're not even here, she replied, tapping at the phone screen. Could be a glitch. She kept tapping at the screen, but said nothing else to me. A short while later, after our tea and goodbyes, and as I was saying my goodbyes at the door at the museum, the woman with the Boston accent was the last to thank me for the tour and shake my hand, but suggested kindly if I told my story again, I should at least make up an actual ending for it. In the days that followed, the dead were dead to me, or more precisely, I was dead to them. They had ghosted me. And after enduring their constant intrusions, that was fine by me. But the more I didn't see them, the more a sense of unease overtook me, and the memory of the fingers of the three pointed like blades at me pushed me towards paranoia. Like Halloween, when the veil between the worlds was thin, there was one other season when the pagans of old gathered for the long night to drink, feast, keep the fires lit till dawn, and tell tales of the spirits who walked the darkest night of the year, when they enjoyed free access to the unwary living. The Germanic people huddled in their feast tables, wary of ghosts, flesh-eating monsters and dragons, called it Yule. We call it Christmas Eve. I was well aware this Christmas Eve was already haunted by the specter of the COVID virus. Can cut this part off. Christmas arrived and I awaited the appearance of my ghostly trio. As I sat alone in my apartment in a state of apprehension, contrarily, I continued my own personal holiday tradition of watching a DVD of the Alistair Sim Christmas Carol. Sim Scrooge had been brought by the black-shrouded spirit of Christmas yet to come to his own graveside when my three dead acquaintances made their expected holiday visit. They appeared at the door of my living room as if they had been looking for me throughout my apartment. I paused the DVD in mid-frame of the spirit pointing a bony finger at the headstone coldly chiseled with Scrooge's name. "Why are you haunting me?" I asked in a more peevish voice than I intended. They ignored my question, but seemed more momentarily distracted by the image on the TV. "What are you doing here?" I tried again. They formed a semicircle around where I sat, transfixed with anxiety. I remembered their word return. "What is it that you want to return to?" I asked. No response. An idea flashed through my thoughts. "Who do you want to return to?" I asked. The little girl looked at me and smiled and said in a small, faraway voice, "Maver." The tall gentleman who looked like a French aristocrat with a wistful smile murmured, "Philippe." The old man in the overalls broke out in a gap-toothed grin and sung up the word, "Irina." The green ghostly glow the trio emanated warmed and intensified for all three of them into a ripe citrusy orange. They each repeated their one word as their faces shone brighter with happiness, and with the snapping sound of a curtain being swept closed, they were gone. I sat mute for a long time and finally turned off the DVD with Scrooge stranded at his own graveside, yet to be redeemed. They had remembered. a happy memory. In Tyndale, the distinguishing feature of the dead was their inability to dispel regret, to voice an honest emotion, to move on from heartbreak, to find joy again, to do what the living did every day. But here it was, right in front of me. It was possible, not because I saw it happen for my dead visitors, because I had felt it in my own being. As each of them spoke their one word, I heard a name pronounced in my head, the name of a person whom I had not laid eyes on for decades, a name I had not said out loud for several years, and then self-consciously in a dismissive manner. But yet, a name that gave me joy. This life offers no promise of permanence, and even in the best of times, life is full of crossroads and detours, destinations that were in nobody's travel plans. And the only promise life keeps is the one we all will join the roll of the dead. But this night, this encounter, I gleaned the hope after I joined the ranks of the dead. One word freighted with a meaning and emotion belonging only to me might survive. A single breath of a name. It seemed like a great gift and a surprising one, but then again, it was a new day. It was Christmas Day.
Auggie Wren's Christmas by Paul Auster. I heard this story from Auggie Wren. Since Auggie doesn't come off too well in it, at least not as well as he'd like to, he's asked me not to use his real name. Other than that, the whole business about the lost wallet and the blind woman and the Christmas dinner is just as he told it to me. Auggie and I have known each other for close to 11 years now. He works behind the counter of a cigar store on Court Street in downtown Brooklyn, and since it's the only store that carries the little Dutch cigars I like to smoke, I go in there fairly often. For a long time, I didn't give much thought to Auggie Wren. He was the strange little man who wore a hooded blue sweatshirt and sold me cigars and magazines. The impish, wisecracking character who always had something funny to say about the weather, the Mets, or the politicians in Washington, and that was the extent of it. But then one day, several years ago, he happened to be looking through a magazine in the store, and he stumbled across the review of one of my books. He knew it was me because a photograph accompanied the review, and after the things changed between us. I was no longer just another customer to Auggie. I had become a distinguished person. Most people couldn't care less about books and writers, but it turned out that Auggie considered himself an artist. Now that he had cracked the secret of who I was, he embraced me as an ally, a confidant, a brother in arms. To tell the truth, I found it rather embarrassing. Then, almost inevitably, a moment came when he asked if I would be willing to look at his photographs. Given his enthusiasm and goodwill, there didn't seem any way I could turn him down. God knows what I was expecting. At the very least, that wasn't what Auggie showed me the next day. In a small, windowless room at the back of the store, he opened a cardboard box and pulled out 12 identical photo albums. This was his life's work, he said, and it didn't take him more than 5 minutes a day to do it. Every morning for the past 12 years, he had stood on the corner of Atlantic Avenue and Clinton Street at precisely 7 o'clock and had taken a single color photograph of precisely the same view. The project now ran to more than 4,000 photographs. Each album represented a different year, and all the pictures were laid out in sequence, from January 1 to December 31, with the dates carefully recorded under each one. As I flipped through the albums and began to study Augie's work, I didn't know what to think. My first impression was that it was the oddest, most bewildering thing I'd ever seen. All the pictures were the same. The whole project was a numbing onslaught of repetition, the same street and the same buildings, over and over again, an unrelenting delirium of redundant images. I couldn't think of anything to say to Augie, so I continued turning pages, nodding my head in feigned appreciation. Augie himself seemed unperturbed, watching me with a broad smile on his face. But after he'd seen that I'd been at it for several minutes, he suddenly interrupted and said, "You're going too fast. You'll never get it if you don't slow down." He was right, of course. If you don't take the time to look, you'll never manage to see anything. I picked up another album and forced myself to go more deliberately. I paid closer attention to the details, took note of the shifts in weather, watched for the changing angles of light as the seasons advanced. Eventually, I was able to detect subtle differences in the traffic flow, to anticipate the rhythm of the different ways, the commotion of workday mornings, the relative stillness of weekends, the contrast between Saturdays and Sundays. And then, little by little, I began to recognize the faces of the people in the background, the passerbys on their way to work, the same people in the same spot every morning, living an instant of their lives in the field of Augie's camera. Once I got to know them, I began to study their postures, the way they carried themselves from one morning to the next, trying to discover their moods from these surface indications, as if I could imagine stories for them, as if I could penetrate the invisible dramas locked inside their bodies. I picked up another album. I was no longer bored, no longer puzzled, as I had been at first. Augie was photographing time, I realized, both natural time and human time, and he was doing it by planting himself in one tiny corner of the world and willing it to be his own, by standing guard in the space he had chosen for himself. As he watched me pore over his work, Augie continued to smile with pleasure. Then, almost as if he'd been reading my thoughts, he began to recite a line from Shakespeare. "Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow," he muttered under his breath, "time creeps on its petty pace." I understood then that he knew exactly what he was doing. That was more than 2,000 pictures ago. Since that day, Augie and I have discussed his work many times, but it was only last week that I learned how he acquired his camera and started taking pictures in the first place. That was the subject of the story he told me, and I'm still struggling to make sense of it. Earlier that same week, a man from the New York Times called me and asked if I would be willing to write a short story that would appear in the paper on Christmas morning. My first impulse was to say no, but the man was very charming and persistent, and by the end of the conversation, I told him I would give it a try. The moment I hung up the phone, however, I fell into a deep panic. What did I know about Christmas? I asked myself. What did I know about writing short stories on commission? I spent the next several days in despair, warring with the ghosts of Dickens, O. Henry, and other masters of the Yuletide spirit. The very phrase, Christmas story, had unpleasant associations for me, evoking dreadful outpourings of hypocritical mush and treacle. Even at their best, Christmas stories were no more than wish-fulfillment dreams, fairy tales for adults, and I'd be darned if I'd ever write myself something like that. And yet, how could anyone propose to write an unsentimental Christmas story? It was a contradiction in terms, and an impossibility, an out-and-out conundrum. One might just as well imagine a racehorse without legs, or a sparrow without wings. I got nowhere. On Thursday, I went out for a long walk, hoping the air would clear my head. Just past noon, I stopped in at the cigar store to replenish my supply, and there was Augie, standing behind the counter as always. He asked me how I was. Without really meaning to, I found myself unburdening my troubles to him. "A Christmas story," he said after I'd finished. "Is that all? If you buy me lunch, my friend, I'll tell you the best Christmas story you ever heard, and I guarantee that every word of it is true." We walked down the block to Jack's, a cramped and boisterous delicatessen with good pastrami sandwiches and photographs of old Dodgers teams hanging on the wall. We found a table in back, ordered our food, and then Augie launched into his story. It was the summer of 72, we said. A kid came in one morning and started stealing things from the store. He must have been about 19 or 20, and I don't think I've ever seen a more pathetic shoplifter in my life. He's standing by the rack of paperbacks along the far wall and stuffing books into the pockets of his raincoat. It was crowded around the counter just then, so I didn't see him at first, but once I noticed what he was up to, I started to shout. He took off like a jackrabbit, and by the time I managed to get out from behind the counter, he was already tearing down Atlantic Avenue. I chased after him for about half a block, and then I gave up. He dropped something along the way, and since I didn't feel like running anymore, I bent down to see what it was. It turned out to be his wallet. There wasn't any money inside, but his driver's license was there, along with three or four snapshots. I suppose I could have called the cops, had him arrested. I had his name and address from the license, but I felt kind of sorry for him. He was just a measly little punk, and once I looked at those pictures in his wallet, I couldn't bring myself to feel very angry at him. Robert Goodwin. That was his name. In one of the pictures, I remember he was standing with his arm around his mother or grandmother. Another one, he was sitting there at age 9 or 10, dressed in a baseball uniform with a big smile on his face. I just didn't have the heart. He was probably on dope now, I figured. Poor kid from Brooklyn, without much going for him. Who cared about a couple of trashy paperbacks anyway? So I held on to the wallet. Every once in a while, I get a little urge to send it back to him. But I kept delaying and never did anything about it. Then Christmas rolls around and I'm stuck with nothing to do. The boss usually invites me over to his house to spend the day, but that year he and his family were down in Florida visiting relatives. So I'm sitting in my apartment that morning feeling a little sorry for myself, and then I see Robert Goodwin's wallet lying on a shelf in the kitchen. I figure, what the hell, why not do something nice for once? Put on my coat and go out to return the wallet in person. The address was over in Borum Hill, somewhere in the projects. It was freezing out that day, and I remember getting lost a few times, trying to find the right building. Everything looks the same in that place, and you keep going over the same ground thinking you're somewhere else. Anyway, I finally get to the apartment I'm looking for and ring the bell. Nothing happens. I assume no one's there. I try again just to make sure. I wait a little longer. Just when I'm about to give up, I hear someone shuffling to the door. An old woman's voice asks who's there, and I say I'm looking for Robert Goodwin. "Is that you, Robert?" the old woman says, and then she undoes about 15 locks and opens the door. She has to be at least 80, maybe 90 years old, and the first thing I notice about her is that she's blind. "I knew you'd come, Robert," she says. "I knew you wouldn't forget your granny, Ethel, on Christmas morning." And then she opens her arms as if she's about to hug me. I didn't have much time to think, you understand. I had to say something real fast. Before I knew what was happening, I could hear the words coming out of my mouth. "That's right, Granny Ethel," I said. "I came back to see you on Christmas." Don't ask me why I did it. I don't have any idea. Maybe I didn't want to disappoint her or something. I don't know. It just came out that way. And then this old woman was suddenly hugging me there in front of the door, and I was hugging her back. I didn't exactly say I was her grandson, not in so many words at least, but that was the implication. I wasn't trying to trick her, though. It was like a game we both decided to play without having to discuss the rules. I mean, that woman knew I wasn't her grandson, Robert. She was old and dotty, but she wasn't so far gone that she couldn't tell the difference between a stranger and her own flesh and blood. But her made her happy to pretend, and since I had nothing better to do anyway, I was happy to go along with her. So we went into the apartment and spent the day together. The place was a real dump, I might add, but what can you expect from a blind woman who does her own housekeeping? Every time she asked me a question about how I was, I would lie to her. I told her I found a good job working in a cigar store. I told her I was about to get married. I told her 100 pretty stories, and she made like she believed every one of them. "That's fine, Robert," she would say, nodding her head and smiling. "I always knew things would work out for you." After a while, I started getting pretty hungry. There didn't seem to be much food in the house, so I went out to a store in the neighborhood and brought back a mess of stuff. A pre-cooked chicken, vegetable soup, a bucket of potato salad, a chocolate cake. all kinds of things. Ethel had a couple of bottles of wine stashed in her bedroom, and so between us we managed to put together a fairly decent Christmas dinner. We both got a little tipsy from the wine, I remember, and after the meal was over we went to sit in the living room where the chairs were more comfortable. I had to take a pee, so I excused myself and went to the bathroom down the hall. That's where things took yet another turn. It was ditzy enough doing my little jig as Ethel's grandson, but what I did next was positively crazy, and I've never forgiven myself for it. I go into the bathroom, stacked up against the wall next to the shower. I see a pile of 6 or 7 cameras. Brand new 35mm cameras, still in their boxes, top quality merchandise. I figure this is the work of the real Robert, storage place for one of his recent hauls. Never taken a picture in my life, I've certainly never stolen anything, but the moment I see those cameras sitting in the bathroom, I decide I wanted one of them for myself, just like that. Without even stopping to think, I tuck one of those boxes under my arm and go back to the living room. I couldn't have been gone for more than 3 minutes, but in that time Granny Ethel had fallen asleep in her chair. Too much Chianti, I suppose. I went in the kitchen and washed the dishes. She slept through the whole racket, snoring like a baby. There didn't seem any point in disturbing her, so I decided to leave. I couldn't even write a note to say goodbye, seeing that she was blind and all. So I just left. I put her grandson's wallet on the table, picked up the camera again, walked out of the apartment. And that's the end of the story. Did you ever go back to see her? I asked. Once, he said, about 3 or 4 months later. I felt so bad about stealing the camera I hadn't even used it yet. I finally made up my mind to return it. But Ethel wasn't there anymore. I don't know what happened to her. But someone else had moved into the apartment, and he couldn't tell me where she was. She probably died. Yeah, probably. Which means that she spent her last Christmas with you. I guess. I never thought of it that way. It was a good deed, doggy. It was a nice thing you did for her. I lied to her, and then I stole from her? I don't see how you can tell that a good deed. You made her happy, and the camera was stolen anyway. It's not as if the person you took it from really owned it. Anything for art, eh, Paul? I wouldn't say that, but at least you put the camera to good use. And now you got your Christmas story, don't you? Yes, I said. I suppose I do. I paused for a moment, studying Augie as a wicked grin spread across his face. I couldn't be sure, but the look in his eyes at that moment was so mysterious, so fraught with the glow of some inner delight, that it suddenly occurred to me that he had made the whole thing up. I was about to ask him if he'd been putting me on, but then I realized he'd never tell. I had been tricked into believing him. That was the only thing that mattered. As long as there's one person to believe it, there's no story that can't be true. You're an ace, Augie, I said. Thanks for being so helpful. Any time, he answered, still looking at me with that maniacal light in his eyes. After all, if you can't share your secrets with your friends, what kind of friend are you? I guess I owe you one. No, you don't. Just put it down the way I told it to you. You don't owe me a thing. Except the lunch. That's right. Except the lunch. I returned Augie's smile with a smile of my own, and then I called out to the waiter and asked for the check.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sunday at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-284-NEWS. That's 902-284-6397. Or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcasts, available now online at coastalradio.ca.